You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 245.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. So today is going to be a solo show, just me. I have a few things to talk about. And even though we have a rare moment where we have some interviews in the can, you know, I'd like to come by and tell you about some cool things in probability theory that I am looking into and researching, and hopefully I'll try to make it accessible. But first, hey, it's been a few weeks since we've done a news update, and by the way, I should acknowledge, I know this episode is coming out a day late. That is because, we had the Rosh Hashanah holiday over the last couple of days, and so it was just easier to get this done after, not before, and I was having a good time. Everything's good, but wanted to give myself a little break, I realized that I wanted to do this topic justice today because it's a really good topic. But a few quick updates before we get started. I know there's an election coming up. We are looking for political stories on the midterm elections in the U.S. And usually what we've done in the past is we've talked about some of the statistical variation in the election predictions and some of the problems wrought by that. And, you know, I think there's a lot that can be said about it that we already said in the last two election cycles. So I'm not sure if we're going to find anything on that. We also love to talk about electoral systems. If any area is using a different type of electoral system, maybe we'll talk about that. But hey, I'm not sure. I'm sure something will come up, but I don't just want to repeat what I've done over the last couple of years. Looking into the mailbag to start out, Ben writes, your episode on AI art did not mention that some Renaissance painters used the camera obscura to add perspective effects to their art. That use might be called technology-assisted art. He gave some references. So the AI art episode, that was a few episodes ago. That was, I believe, episode 242. Let me write that down so that... that goes in the show notes page. So episode 242, the camera obscura is, it's not an actual camera. It kind of looks like a camera. You could do it homemade with some cardboard and some glass. And I believe they were doing that several hundred years ago. And you could basically project light onto a flat surface. So you can sort of project the light coming in from an image somewhere else, and then you could sort of paint over that image. And so that could be an example of art that is used to or technology that is used to create art. And it's interesting because none of this technology actually makes the artist obsolete, although some of this technology does kind of change what artists can do. So for example, I would assume that hundreds of years ago, before there was an actual photograph camera, the idea that you're going to do a painting that looks as photorealistic as possible. I'm going to make this painting look as much like a photograph as possible, even though they don't have photographs. I feel like that would be something that that people would want. You know, particularly a rich person might want a painting of themselves or their family that looks realistic. Once you have the camera available, well that sort of that sort of task heads to the photographers, and the painter or artist of some kind can focus on other aspects of the craft. And so I think that AI art is the same. It's not going to replace artists. It's not going to replace digital artists. I can't say it won't replace it in them in any way, but it won't wholesale replace the act of digital art. And so I think that I agree. That's a good analogy. Just technology changes the art. It's always been there. There's always been concerns that people are going to be replaced. Sometimes those concerns are not misplaced, but oftentimes they're not as wholesale and complete as you would believe. Now, some people, you know, they believe, well, AI is going to be the wholesale and complete replacement of everything because we're going to have general AI. A, we're not there yet. And B, I don't even know if that does it, but we'll see. Secondly, we had, over the last few weeks, something called the Ethereum Merge, which we covered in episode 240. We talked about Ethereum was going on proof of stake, and they're moving off proof of work. And, you know, I thought that there was a, because I have not, reviewed the code myself, I was like, okay, well, I'm a little worried, you know, could this go horribly wrong? And can we see some things fall apart? Well, so far, it seems to have gone reasonably well, and it seems to be kind of a big bore, which is what you want in technology. That's a good thing. As I talked about last time, there's also a forked coin from some miners of Ethereum who didn't want to stop mining Ethereum the old way because they were making a lot of money off of it. So they decided to keep doing it the old way. And so we have a new coin. So if you own one Ethereum, congratulations. You also own one FW, Ethereum Proof of Work. The futures were $50. You know, I predicted, you know, there could be like a giant rush to sell, but it wasn't as dramatic as previous forks of Bitcoin were. Today, it sits as only $10, at only $10. So as expected, it's not a major player, but, you know, it's approaching, I don't know, even if you can split your Ethereum and sell it, it's approaching a 1% additional return. So maybe not so bad, so long as you do it safely. But it does seem to exist. So I was thinking, you know, it's so complicated, maybe it won't exist. And who knows, maybe it won't after a few months or so. Or it might find some kind of use case and it might maintain that low value. We'll see. The price of Ethereum has gone down in the meantime. I believe that that's just part of the ebbs and flows of crypto. But now the new supply coming into Ethereum is going to be cut fairly dramatically. And presumably that's permanently, although some say that it's not as permanent as Bitcoin is, because Bitcoin with proof of work is much harder to change. Ethereum is easier to change. So, but it still is a cut in supply. So I predict that a new run-up will occur sometime in the next 6 months. And once this new supply is kind of felt by the market, and I know some people will always tell me, hey, it's, the market prices it in. But I don't know. I feel like it's, I feel like there are other factors going into whether people are buying it or not right now. And I think this gets felt when all of a sudden, you know, the newly mined coins are no longer hitting the exchanges anymore, and you kind of run out, and then all of a sudden people realize there isn't enough to go around, and there's a big price run up. So I think that might happen in the next 6 months. Actually, I'm going to predict that happens in the next 6 months. So if I'm wrong, you can tell me that I'm wrong. But I really think that's going to happen. Okay, so I have recently been looking at the foundations of probability. In fact, I am writing a paper on it, on the foundations of probability theory. That is how mathematicians define probability at its most basic level. So I talked in episode 145 about the different interpretations of probability, and we've done a whole lot of episodes on it. So some people take the subjective view of probability. You know, it's all about beliefs. Some people take the frequentist view of probability, like it's all about the ratios of counts of things that you see over time. And this is less about the interpretation and more about the foundational mathematics of it, the philosophy of, well, you know, how do you work with probabilities in the mathematical realm? And I've come across a lot of writings to that end, philosophical writings to be exact, on Kolmogorov's axioms of probability. So let me talk a little bit about, Kolmogorov was a mathematician in the 20th century, early 20th century, a Soviet mathematician, and he created the kind of modern day probability theory. He's kind of one of the big, you know, players in the field of math. I would have to talk to mathematicians who have a little bit more background in this, but I would assume if you would make a list of the top 10 mathematicians in the 20th century, Kolmogorov would certainly be on that list. So he created a set of axioms for probability, and some of you might remember what axioms are, but I want to talk a little bit about what they are. You know, in math, they're assumptions that are made in mathematics that help us define what we're talking about. So, you know, unlike things like texts or words or even religious texts or even laws, axioms are designed to be not open to interpretation. It's not like they come down from on high and then you're stuck with them, but they usually come down and then you work within them because they've proven to be they've proven to work and be consistent and be and actually define what everyone is talking about. So it's almost like an ironclad definition based on logic, a mathematical definition. And I like to say that these axioms, they conjure up worlds. They're like they're like incantation that conjures up spirits. You create a new set of mathematical axioms, and they might not necessarily be, you know, assumptions on the most basic level. Like in probability theory, it's like, okay, I have a set and a function with these types of, with these types of properties. So it's like, okay, assumptions about what you have. But once you create that small set of rules, all this beautiful mathematics comes out of it. So that's why I like to use the word conjure. And so you make the rules, and then the rules of the game define what playing that game is going to be like. So let's go through a few examples of axioms throughout history, because they're very interesting. The first one is the one that everybody is taught in grade school. It's one of the oldest examples, and those are the axioms of Euclidean geometry. They're the axioms of Euclid for geometry. He lived around 300 BC. The axioms, of course, they don't look as formal as we make them today. Like today, you know, axioms usually have, some symbolic logic behind it that everyone can agree on. The language is a little more informal because, you know, he didn't have set theory and algebra and all that. But he would say, you know, for example, one of them is a line can be drawn between two points. And so these have been, of course, reimagined later and formalized later and, of course, challenged, which we'll get to in a little bit. Another one of my favorites, I have three examples. Well, the last one's you could guess. The second example is piano arithmetic. Piano. I'm not sure to pronounce him. I believe he's Italian. This is my favorite example. It's from 1889. And it basically says, how do you construct the natural numbers, the counting numbers? So I look at it today from a computer science perspective, and I kind of look at the first two rules, and I'm like, oh, there are your constructors. There are the two rules that you need to create new numbers. Rule one, you could just start with zero. So zero you could create because there's a rule for that. There's a separate rule for that. And then the other way to create a new number is you could take an existing number and take a successor. And then there are a few rules stating, making sure that, like, you don't get back to something that's equal to where you've already been. And, you know, you have induction, so you make sure that, you know, there aren't extra numbers in there that you can't reach. But that's essentially what piano arithmetic is. It basically just defines the act of counting. I mean, the act of counting sounds simple, but there are rules to this thing, and piano came up with them. So that's pretty cool. The final example, of course, is the Kolmogorov axioms for probability. That's what we're going to talk about more today. So how are axioms created to begin with? They don't come out of thin air. They don't come, you know, Moses doesn't come down from the mountain and share with you the axioms. They usually come from many years or, you know, even generations or centuries of mathematicians working through problems a certain way. And then the people who write these axioms are, what I like to call the systematizers, which some people, I don't know, I feel like I have a mixed view of that word. I feel like every great scientist and mathematician is actually a systematizer, which is so it might sound like a mere kind of bureaucrat, but it's actually a really, really important thing. They write up the rules that the people were following all along. So they look at how we solve problems and what we do to solve problems, what problems are coming up, and then they write the rules that everybody's already using. So it's kind of backwards than you kind of might imagine. So for example, if you take the axiom, you can draw a straight line between two points, I'm sure people were using that assumption well before Euclid. He just noticed that this was one of the basic assumptions that people make in geometry. So why write the rules if people are already following them? That's an interesting question. And I think it's like asking, well, why write a dictionary if people are already using words and they're using them correctly? Or why write down laws if we already enforce laws? Because both language and laws existed before there were writing. And I think the answer is, well, first of all, you're much less likely to make mistakes if it's written down. It gives you more insights into the system we're working on. It makes sure that it's logically consistent. That's really important. And if there are logical inconsistencies, it gives you opportunities to kind of iron those out and learn things. And I think it's also for streamlined education. It's kind of a shortcut for new people coming into whatever field that you're doing to kind of read that kind of short set of principles, and then they don't have to kind of infer it from years and years of experience, although there are things that you infer from years of experience anyway, but it's kind of a shortcut from experience. So if you don't like the rules, in the case of, well, sometimes in the case of the legal system, it's like, we'll reinterpret the rules, reinterpret the Constitution. Maybe that's not a good idea. I don't know. I'm not going to get into that. But axioms usually are not reinterpreted. They're usually just rewritten entirely. So sometimes you can rewrite the rules in a way, the axioms in a way that creates a new type of mathematics. And I'll give an example in a second. But it's not related to what you originally wanted to build sometimes, or sometimes it is related to what you originally wanted to build, and maybe the original axioms were kind of too constricted or led to some bad consequences or something like that. So there's also something that I like to refer to a reformulation of axioms, where you come up with, you're not rewriting the rules, but it's not like you don't, you know, it's not like you don't like the game that you conjured up, but you just want to simplify the rules, but come out with the same game. So this set of axioms and this set of axioms are basically the same exact thing. So for example, in topology, I've read a lot of books, not a lot, but a few books on topology. And topology is, we talked about topology in episode 133, Pointless Topology with Aaron. Topology is the study, I would say, of the connectedness of space. And in continuous space, unlike discrete space, it's hard to say, you know, hey, this point is connected to that point. Well, no two points are connected. You have to go through infinite number of points to get from A to B. But what you can do is you can talk about, okay, like this set of points, this glob of points kind of touches this other point, or this glob of points surrounds this other point. And there are different ways to kind of, different things that you can use to build the axioms of technology. One is the open set. That's the idea that, you know, this is a set that surrounds all of its members. So any member that's in the set, all of the points nearby are also in that set. And there's the idea of the neighborhood where, you know, given a point, another set is a neighborhood if it surrounds that point completely. They're slightly different, concepts, but they are, they can be made essentially equally. And I've read some books that literally, you know, make a set of axioms on open sets, and then make another set of axioms on neighborhoods and say, hey, these two are the same thing. We're talking about the same thing here. So isn't that nice? So that's interesting. It's actually an interesting pursuit, reformulation, I believe. There's sort of an aesthetic thing to it. I kind of feel like you're rearranging the furniture of mathematics. Like, what formulation of rules looks good? What is simpler? What generalizes better? All of those are great questions that people ask. And by the way, I'm hoping that there are non-mathematicians listening to this who kind of think, hey, this does just apply to mathematics, this applies to other things as well. I love doing that in this show, as you know. All right, some examples of this. One is non-Euclidean geometry. So As you might have remembered from school, Euclid had this one rule about parallel lines that always seemed awkward. And some folks a few hundred years ago, they wanted these nice clean axioms, so they thought they'd try to eliminate it and prove it with the other axioms. Because that's one of the things that you could do when you reformulate is like, hey, maybe I could remove this axiom because I could already prove it from the other ones. So, but they weren't able to do it. Instead of doing this, they actually ended up creating a new type of geometry, or several new types of geometry, to be exact. They're all called non-Euclidean geometries, and they actually turned out to have applications in physics down the line and relativity. So really cool stuff. Also explains if you wanted to talk about geometry on the surface of the Earth, but you didn't want to go like three-dimensional, you just wanted the surface of the Earth as like a two-dimensional object, you could describe that as a non-Euclidean geometry, just a different parallel postulate. So that's pretty interesting as well. So what am I looking at these days? I'm actually looking at the Kolmogorov axioms for probability. Kolmogorov was a, like I said before, he was a Soviet mathematician from the early 20th century, a real interesting time in terms of formalizing mathematics. And these were from 1933. And since then, people have been talking about, almost since it was published, people have been talking about kind of reopening those ideas and changing them a little bit and challenging them a little bit. And it's nothing against Kolmogorov, but sometimes we want to create something a little more powerful than what we have. So I found this article that I think I've mentioned on the show before, but I haven't actually gone through it. It's from a few years ago, and it's called Kolmogorov and Its Discontents by Aidan Lyon. And he lays out the case, and I want to get into that. But first, let's ask, I kind of ask myself, what questions should you ask if you want to open up the hood and change the basic assumptions about mathematics? And to me, I rack my brain on this. I think the first one is, what is it that you want to do that you're currently not allowed to do? Sometimes it's to make life simpler. That's one of the things that I'm looking at now with relative probability. The second is maybe there's a good reason why you're not allowed to do those things. Will there be any negative consequences? So fortunately in math, those negative consequences are either paradoxes or more difficult mathematics. And I don't say, some mathematicians say like a paradox, that's a disaster. Well, no one dies. The only disaster is that you throw it out. So it's still interesting to explore it. And the third is, why did the existing axiom system last so long? What is its staying power, and has anything changed? And I think we're going to have to answer that question for Kolmogorov as well. And by the way, mathematicians are totally allowed to work with alternative assumptions so long as they're explicit about this. There's no Congress of mathematicians that decide on the axioms and then everybody must follow it, or face penalties. But they just come to some standards over time. So there's no rush in changing it unless a certain way of doing it has become more popular over time. And then, the textbooks start to change. But it's a very, very, very long process. So I think the answer to that third question, what's keeping Kolmogorov on top and what's changed? And Lyon's answer is too. I think that the axioms he came up with describe almost all situations you'd want in the real world. And the few exceptions right now, you kind of one-off them. You say, well, this one doesn't follow Kolmogorov, but we'll call it something else and we'll move on. And so I think it hasn't been that much of a burden to mathematicians. Though sometimes, for example, one of the assumptions is countable additivity. If it doesn't have that, some textbooks say, well, that's a content probability, not a measure probability. And I find that wording very awkward, but I'm sure there's a reason for that. So what's changed in the last 100 years, or 90, or 87, or 80, no, 90 years, 89 years, 1933? God, I gotta do subtraction in my head. Well, it isn't obvious. It is obvious to me. I wrote, isn't it obvious? The last 50 years in particular, the late 20th century, the early 21st century, or even the mid 20th century, has brought, mass computation to probability, specifically Bayesian probability on a scale previously unimagined. We're running a lot of algorithms to search hypothesis spaces in Bayesian mathematics, you know, Markov chain Monte Carlo and all that stuff. But, you know, you might think, and you'd be correct, that shouldn't change the principles of mathematics. The principles of mathematics are the same. It doesn't. But if new types of problems tend to surface, you often want to rethink the foundations and kind of to reflect that, to make those problems more kind of front and center. So let's get into some specifics here. What did Kolmogorov have to say about probability? So he said, all right, there's something called a measurable set. And these are the things that we want to, these are called events, and we want these events to have probabilities. And, you know, they have certain properties that we can't get into, but like the union of two events, the intersection of two events, those are also events, et cetera, et cetera. So then you have this probability function that turns an event into a number. So it sets the probability of the event between 0 and 1. The probability of the empty set, the empty event, you know, has to be 0. And the set of all possibilities of anything happening has to be 1. So that's kind of obvious. So, like, usually the outcome space that the event encaptures, you kind of assume that one of the outcomes is going to occur. And the event is a set of those outcomes. So it's like, are any of these outcomes going to occur? And then the probability that any outcome occurs of the whole thing is going to be 1. So I guess there's I was almost thinking, well, what if you have a dartboard? The probability that the dart lands on the dartboard it would be 1 because you assume that the person hits the dartboard. But maybe that's not true. Maybe our hypothesis space is the dart either hits a point on the dartboard or it doesn't make it. It hits a point off the dartboard or doesn't hit at all. And so that's a separate outcome. But you would say, okay, the probability of one of those two things, of any point on the dartboard or the dart not hitting, the probability of all of those would have to be 1. Okay, and then the final axiom, and this is the kicker. This is the one that I think usually in most axiom systems, there's kind of one rule that sort of ties it all together, that kind of puts the stake in the sand and says, this is what we're talking about today. So this is the additivity requirement. And that says that if you have two sets that are disjoint, then their probabilities add. So, you know, if I have a dartboard with two bullseyes, you know, the probability of getting it in the first bullseye, and they're separate, so it's kind of it almost looks like a pair of eyes. Imagine that. The first bullseye has a certain probability. The second bullseye has a certain probability. The probability that you get either of those bullseyes has to be the sum of those. And so that's really important because I think that I think that. Otherwise, you know, what are you talking about? You're just making up numbers. Yeah, all of the axioms before says, okay, here are the things that we're acting on, and we're turning them into numbers. The numbers represent probabilities, but until you have something that ties it together and you create some rules on those numbers, you're just making up numbers, and so you can't really interpret them very much. So this additivity requirement is very important, and then Kolmogorov has an even stronger, makes it even stronger, and he says that if we have an infinite list of countable sets that also add up, then the union of all those sets, you know, has to be the sum of that kind of infinite sum of all of the, you know, all of the parts. So in other words, if you have like a dartboard and you create like an infinite number of squares on it, but you know each square gets smaller and smaller, so maybe it's a finite area. But if you add up the probability of each of the squares, then the probability of any square has to be equal to that infinite sum. So that is called countable additivity. For those of you who are not well-versed in higher mathematics, that you might not have heard that before, but that's like a stronger requirement. So, what are the discontents that Lyons talks about? Lyons goes into a whole bunch of different issues that people have taken with this. One issue is the issue of conditional probability. See, oftentimes you talk about what's the probability of this happening given that this, that happens? So in other words, like, you know, what's the probability that my candidate wins the election given that some event occurs, you know, maybe given that the president in that candidate's party has a approval rating less than 40%, you know, or given that the president has an approval rating above 50%, you know, that could change. You know, I could say, hey, I'm giving you more information, so your probability will change. So a good example that they give is in these papers is, okay, what's the probability that a random point on Earth is going to be in the Western Hemisphere? And, you know, because we could idealize the Earth as a sphere, we sort of assume that we're picking a random point on the sphere, which you can do, random uniform distribution on the sphere. We haven't talked about that distribution yet, but it'll come. So Western Hemisphere, pretty obvious. It's one half, 50% chance you're in the Western Hemisphere, 50% chance you're in the Eastern Hemisphere. If you add them together, it's 100%. What's the probability that you're on the equator? The probability that you're on the equator exactly is a probability of zero. Even though probability zero events do occur in probability theory, which is one of those really complicated things that I think mathematicians have trouble explaining. But yes, the probability of landing, you could land near the equator. Sure, you might have a pretty good shot of landing near the equator, but landing exactly on the equator, because it's a line and it has no thickness, is zero. So then there's the question of, okay, what is the probability of landing in the Western Hemisphere given that you landed on the equator? Well, usually in Kolmogorov's axioms, that says, okay, well, that's the probability that I'm in the Western Hemisphere and on the equator over the probability that I'm on the equator. And that's zero over zero. And so that's, you know, indeterminate. But, you know, some people would say, well, isn't it obvious that given that you're on the equator, the probability that you're in the Western Hemisphere is also has to be 50%. So this is a topic that I'm currently looking at because I'm writing a paper on relative probability, where I think that probability is kind of a relative affair. Therefore, it makes some of these other statements make sense where you're comparing two events of probability zero. I'm not the first one to talk about this. I'm going to have a little bit of a previous work section, although I don't know if I have time to review all the literature. So I am, I'll do what I think is appropriate. So this is the topic that I'm currently looking at. Let me know what you think about it. localmaxradio@gmail.com. Okay, a second thing that Lyons talks about is countable additivity, this whole infinite sum thing. You know, maybe some people say maybe we can relax that. I'm among them. I think that's actually one of the more important things to relax. I'll give an example at the end of the show that I think most of you will be able to wrap your head around. But basically, pick a random counting number is not allowed by these rules. You have to kind of weight things towards zero for it to make sense. So some of this countable additivity stuff leads to some problems. But not having countable additivity also leads to some problems. So you kind of have to work through that. And a third issue that people have with Kolmogorov's axioms is that maybe we don't want to call the things that we're calculating probability on as sets. Like, you know, Kolmogorov specifically says that these are sets. And the guy who brought up this issue, it wasn't some rando. It was a guy named Karl Popper, who was like ground zero for modern philosophy of science. And so he also says, hey, maybe we don't have to assign a probability for everything. Maybe we don't have to define the probability of A and B or assume it exists, even if we have a probability for A and a probability for B. Maybe the probability of B, A and B doesn't exist. That one, I kind of, even if you don't know the probability of A and B, I feel like assuming it exists doesn't cause any problems. But I'm open to hearing that argument. And another one that I should mention, here's a fourth problem. Or a fourth extension people propose. And for me, this is actually one of the most exciting ones, although I have fewer ideas on how to execute on it, is the idea that maybe we could use a different numbering system for probability. So we use the real number system. Real numbers are pretty well understood by mathematicians. At least we've been working with them for a long time. I do know there are some detractors of the real number systems. But hey, maybe one suggestion is maybe add infinitesimals to that. Use the surreal number system. Another one is to use exotic values for probability, like imaginary numbers, using complex numbers. Believe it or not, that's what quantum physics does. So why don't we update it in that way and try to make our theory of probability based on that? I don't know if that's a good idea or not, but it's certainly been proposed, and I'm open to learning about it because it sounds fascinating. Related, I talked about some of this stuff with Ty Dene Bradley when I talked to her about topology in her new book in episode 146. So I will link that to the show notes page. And finally, at the end of the paper that Lyons wrote about Kolmogorov and his discontents, he suggests that the Kolmogorov axioms have staying power because they're actually a good compromise between all the competing demands on probability practitioners. So maybe if you're a practitioner who wants to draw outside the lines a little bit, you can define your own. In general, you're going to come back to Kolmogorov for like the general use case. So that is, I think this stuff is fascinating. It really goes to the heart of showing how we really don't understand that much about probability yet. And I don't think we'll ever understand that much, but there's so much more, you know, to learn. And there's so many, different ways of thinking about it, that it's such a fascinating topic. And, I hope this stuff gave you some ideas, and, look forward to what I have to say on relative probability in the near future. Maybe in a few weeks, I'll come out with this paper, which is going to be well over 30 pages now. I got a little carried away. We'll see what happens with that. All right. I think we are ready. We're going to stay in the probability realm today, but I think we're ready for our segment.
And now, the probability distribution of the week.
All right. The today's probability distribution is the first one we've done that has an infinite outcome space. So the ones we've done before, like the binomial or, the categorical, is like, hey, there are a bunch of outcomes. There are like six outcomes, maybe, when you roll a die. And maybe if you roll a pair of dice, there are 11 outcomes. But there's like a certain number. There's a fixed number of outcomes. And so basically, we said it's, for a categorical distribution, it's just, you assign a number to each one, and those numbers add up to one. Those are the probabilities. Pretty straightforward. Anyone can understand it. You can understand, kids in grade school can understand that pretty easily. This is the first one that has infinite support. And so the question is, I'm thinking of a number between zero and, well, there's no between, but I'm thinking of a counting number. Zero, one, two, three, four, for example. And here's an example that kind of a motivating example. Let's suppose I'm flipping a coin, and basically I keep flipping the coin until I get tails. Now, you and I both know that if it's a fair coin, I am probably not going to be sitting here all day flipping that coin. I'm not going to be flipping heads. Well, I might say it three times, but at some point I'm going to get tails, and it's going to happen pretty quickly. But if I count the number of heads I get before I get tails, that theoretically could be any number. And so the probability that you get zero heads, like you just start with tails, is a half. The probability of one is a quarter. The probability of two is an eighth, and so on and so forth. So your probabilities for each count go a half, a quarter, an eighth, a sixteenth, and each value is half as likely as the previous value. And you can tell that all of these numbers add to one because, a half plus a fourth plus a quarter, a half plus a quarter plus an eighth plus a sixteenth, so on and so forth, those add up to one. So that's really fortunate. You can kind of, it meets Kolmogorov's axiom of countable additivity, and it works pretty well. We could generalize this. It doesn't have to be half. Now, you can't, you know, start with a third. You can't say like, okay, the first step is a third likely, and the second is a ninth likely, and then the next is 1/27th likely, and you're dividing by 3 every time because they won't add up to 1. They'll add up to some smaller number, but you can multiply it by some factor. So basically, you can make the multiplication constant anything, any number that's less than 1, and you could be like, hey, each value is a tenth as likely as the previous value. Each value is a hundredth as likely as the previous value. You know, those values will tend to be very small. Or you go in the opposite direction. You could say, you know, hey, I have a certain probability for 0, and then the next probability is maybe 70% of that, and then the next probability is 70% of that, and so on and so forth. And so this always converges. It can always be normalized. It converges because something called the geometric series, and I mean, you guys can look it up, but basically, it has a formula which is like 1/1 - r. So that makes sense. The formula for a third would be 1/1 - 1/3, 3/2. So you'd have to multiply by 3/2 if your multiplier is a third. Don't worry about that right now. All I'm concerned with is the next item in the sequence is a certain percentage less than the current item in the sequence, or a certain fraction of the current items in the sequence, and it's constant as you go throughout the sequence. So that is the geometric distribution. It's really good for those things like coins, trying to figure out, okay, how long is it going to take me to get ahead or something, get ahead, to get a tails. That's why I didn't use heads there, because then I said, how long it takes me to get ahead. And then it sounds like a head, one word. But anyway, sorry. All right. What an aside. I think this is a good time to take a sip of water because I am rambling. All right. Hang on. So we talked about Kolmogorov's axioms today. How are we doing with this geometric distribution? Well, it's actually a perfect example of a distribution that meets all the Kolmogorov's axioms. You know, any subset of natural numbers under this scheme can be assigned a probability. Interestingly, in the 1/2 case, you know, let's suppose you want to know, okay, what's the probability that the number of heads is going to be an even number? And so 0 is in, 2 is in, 4 is in, etc. If you create a binary decimal, and I know that sounds, you know, contradictory because decimal means out of 10 and binary means out of 2, but what I mean is, you know, 0 dot, and then you have binary places to the right of the 0 indicating fractions, the powers of 2, then you could create kind of an infinite decimal of binary digits that go like, you know, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, and so that's an infinite repeating decimal, and that converges to something. It converges to some number, and that any subset of natural numbers can be assigned a probability in that way. So really fascinating. And then, of course, you have countable additivity. So I talked about breaking the Kolmogorov axioms. Why did I give an example of a distribution that meets the Kolmogorov axiom? Well, there's a catch here. Suppose that you want to create a geometric distribution that isn't so weighted toward the low numbers. So you pick a multiplier that's really close to 1. So let's say you want whatever the probability of n is, you want the probability of n plus 1 to be, say, 99.99% of n. So, you know, the likelihood of 10 looks very much the same as the likelihood of 11. You probably wouldn't, you'd prefer 10 slightly, but, you know, they're going to look very much the same. And it takes a long time before you see a dip in probability. So even at 99.99%, you know, the probability of 1,000 is 90%, which has still maintained a lot of its value as compared, for example, to the coin flipping, where, you know, you'll never get to 1,000. I mean, theoretically it could, but never. So although it does drop fast because then at a million, it's down to zero. But you could keep adding nines. You could say 99.99999. But let's say you want that to approach 100%. And you want each number to be exactly equal to the previous number. Well, first of all, there's a lot that can be said about that distribution, which I will, you know, in the future, where doesn't it create values that are too high? By too high, I mean like unbelievably higher because than anything you could imagine. So when you let that approach 100%, that leads to another distribution, or what I call a distribution. It's called the fair countable lottery, which I won't get into today. We'll get into another time. But it is going to cause problems for Kolmogorov's axioms because it's not countably additive. And yet, we informally use it all the time. At least as an approximation to what we're doing. You know, we at least say, hey, let's just assume that all numbers are equally likely, even though we know that's probably not you know, physically feasible. So the geometric distribution, simple, elegant, unbelievably useful, plays by all of the rules. But even on its own terms, we find lurking in the corner, lurking in the limit, something that doesn't quite sit right. So we'll talk about that another time. Keep listening to The Local Maximum. Next week, I have another crowd pleaser of an interview on The Local Maximum. We're going to interview A.J. Jacobs. He wrote a book called The Puzzler. And some of you are probably, I've talked to some listeners. People are a lot more familiar with A.J. Jacobs than I thought. He wrote a whole book on the history of puzzles and different types of riddles and crosswords and solving them and why people do it. And we had a really great conversation on that. So make sure you tune in to The Local Maximum next week. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support The Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week. Feel the power.